Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we bring you a panel discussion about innovation with insights from Scott Garvey of Grain News, Barb Glenn of The Western Producer, and Country Guide's Tom Button. We'll also take a look at markets with Phil France Workington of Commodity News Service. But first, here's today's host, Laura Rance.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows, a weekly podcast by Glacier Farm Media. I'm Laura Rance, your host for this week's program. To help us explore the ways that innovation could soon be affecting how you farm, we've assembled a panel of senior editors from Glacier Farm Media Publications. Joining me by phone is Scott Garvey, machinery editor for Grain News, Tom Button, editor of The Country Guide, and Barb Glenn, the Western Producer's livestock editor and the editor who pulled together that paper's recent innovation issue. Let's start with you, Scott. What have you seen lately on the machinery side of things that interests you the most?
I guess it would be hard to miss the real force that's behind machinery engineering now, and that's automation. Probably the biggest shock to anyone at a farm machinery show this year was in Boone, Iowa, at the U.S. Farm Progress Show, where Case IH and its sister brand, New Holland, both introduced autonomous tractors in a high-horsepower tractor that the company says they expect to have market ready within about 3 years.
3 years. I mean, we've been talking about robotic tractors for over a decade. I mean, are they really that close to market?
Well, yeah, that's right. We've seen smaller versions of autonomous tractors show up at all sorts of farm machinery shows, especially Agritechnica in Germany, but no major brand has ever introduced anything like the Magnum and T8 that CNH Industrials companies did this year. And the thought amongst everyone in the industry is that we could have had realistically robotic tractors in a high horsepower model working on farms 10 years ago if companies had been willing to go forward with it, with that concept. And what's really been holding them back, particularly in North America, is U.S. liability law. No one is really too eager to put out a machine, a driverless machine, that it could go haywire and cause a bunch of damage and have the company civilly liable. And I've spoken to senior machinery company executives over the years, and that's been the one dominating force that's been holding them back. But they're hoping that new legislation in a lot of jurisdictions will come into place, and really the market is going to get ahead of them if they don't start looking at an off-the-shelf robotic tractor, you know, within the near future.
Well, I mean, it's easy to imagine the concept, but what do you see as being sort of the first commercial use of this on the farm? I mean, is this going to result in the farmer sitting in his office and basically controlling the farm from there?
That's what everyone sort of envisions, is that ultimately, you will be in your farm office, and your computer or your tablet or even your cell phone will allow you to have a view of cameras from machines that are working in your fields, all sorts of things like that, where you really hardly ever get into the field. Actually, Harper Adams University in Great Britain right now has started what they call the Hands-Free Hector project, where this university, in cooperation with an ag services provider in Great Britain, is going to seed, tend, and harvest 1 hectare of cereal grain this coming season without ever setting foot in the field. So that's the ultimate. AGCO is also working on a new project in conjunction with the University of Ulm, and is sponsored by the European Union, called MARS, which is an acronym for the Mobile Agricultural Robot Swarm, which envisions having a bunch of very small-scale little robots go out into a field and seed the crop entirely and get cloud-based data that shows precisely where every seed is actually placed. So that's the long term. How we get to that is probably going to be some combination of machines that are both capable of robotic operation or standard, having a driver in the seat, and we'll kind of gradually move toward that.
Barb, the Western producer also looked at the robotic tractor issue, but what were some of the other stories that really jumped out at you from the work that your team put together for the innovations issue?
I think a few things that leaped out were alternative proteins and innovations that are aimed in that direction, those being primarily pulse crops and even insects. And then innovative methods of farming, methods beyond what the standard is, which is, you know, iron in the dirt. Things like aquaponics and vertical farming or aeroponics.
I guess, a lot of us in the media have a lot of fun with the insect protein side of things. I mean, just because of the ick factor. But the reality is it's something that's standard in some countries, and there are Canadian companies that are getting involved with this. Where do you see this, or how soon do you see this coming to a restaurant near you?
Well, according to our story, which was written by our reporter, Sean Pratt, some restaurants are experimenting with it. But as you say, Laura, the ick factor is ever present. But bear in mind that I read once, and maybe some of my colleagues on this call can confirm, but we've been probably eating insect parts for years in flour just because of the way the harvest and flour processing system works. So, I don't know. We might be eating insects more than we know even today.
A little bit of added protein is the joke around home.
That's
when
right.
You find bugs in your flour bin. but what are some of the other alternative proteins that are out there?
Well, the stories that we present in our innovation issue dealt primarily with pulses. So the use of pulse crops, beans, peas, various other pulses. Processed and extruded to resemble a meat product. And a company in the States actually has developed what they call the quote-unquote impossible burger, which is made from pulses, including soy, I believe, that actually has a juice that looks similar to the juice that a hamburger would exude when you bit into it. So he has high hopes for that, appealing to that market that wants to eat less meat, or perhaps the vegan market, people who are concerned about what they understand to be the high carbon footprint of livestock. So, there are a number of avenues of appeal for an alternative protein.
So that really has some implications for how we look at the livestock industry as it moves forward.
It does, and of course the livestock industry is pretty cognizant of that. Another story we did in our recent issue was dealing with how the livestock industry is working to minimize its carbon footprint by monitoring greenhouse gas emissions and altering feedstuff so that livestock emit less GHG. And also there's a lot of innovation going on in genetics and breeding cattle so that they are more efficient users of the food that they eat, so that you get essentially more yield for the feed provided.
Tom, let's bring you in on this. The Country Guide is really all about strategic thinking, but what jumps out at you in terms of innovation and how that factors into the planning that farmers are making?
Yeah, one of the really interesting things, I think, is just this whole field of innovation and how wide it's gotten. I was remembering when I was preparing for this call that I had a conversation with a great uncle of mine a number of years ago, and he had been born in 1920 and had farmed all his life, and I asked him close to the end of his life, I said, you know, what was the big innovation that you saw? What was the big change that affected your life as a farmer? And he said to me, well, that's simple, he said. It was hydraulics. And hydraulics hadn't struck me as the answer that he was going to give me. I thought it would be something, you know, about hybrid corn or some other marketing opportunity or something like that.
Right.
But when you think back to it and you think of all that hydraulics has made possible in agriculture, then you can see, well, yeah, he was probably right to single out hydraulics. But what struck me after that was that, you know, while those innovations at that time were very far-ranging and they really did change how people farmed, there weren't really that many other choices that he could have given me that had affected, you know, there were innovations that had affected him over his lifetime. And I looked, Scott writes a column for us every issue, and I looked at one, I pulled it out, I had looked at it, and it had struck me 2 years ago when he wrote it, and I think it's still just as pertinent as ever. And he was talking about Agritechnica, the show in Germany that he's already mentioned today. And he was talking about the fact that the organizers there had come up with a term, and they called it a innovations offensive, they said, which was what they said the machinery manufacturers were on, an innovations offensive in order to be able to continue to be able to sell to farmers. And that 1 year at Agritechnica, they had 320 new products in machinery alone, as I understand it, that they were showing to farmers. Just the sheer volume of innovations that are being pushed out, whether it's in machinery, whether it's in crop protection or seed genetics, whether it's in marketing opportunities and some of the things that Barbara's just been talking about, it's just a different world. And the ability to sort through those innovations and to determine which ones might be appropriate for which farms is really, it's a different game now than it ever was before.
I think you're right there, and I guess what I'm seeing and wondering, and I'll just throw this out at you, is, you know, how do farmers assess innovation? I mean, how do they, I mean, with new seeds or new tools or new equipment, it's pretty easy to look at and say, yeah, this is going to make a difference on my farm. But some of those things get pretty complicated, don't they? I mean, with market access issues and some of the just the cost of the new innovations, how do farmers make those choices? Let's start with you, Tom.
Yeah, in my head, there are two fundamental kinds of innovations. There's the kinds of innovations that are evolutionary steps, so that if you're already applying herbicides and a new herbicide comes out, you're going to use a different herbicide, but you're primarily using the same sorts of technology to apply it, et cetera, and you're just continuing to evolve, maybe use new tips next year and things like that. But basically the overall process is the same and you're just tweaking it on an ongoing basis. There are other kinds of things, though, that are what we might call step changes. And when Scott was talking about some of these very small tractors, that really seems to me to be a real opportunity for agriculture to go to small and highly roboticized tractors. Those are real step changes, and they require massive amounts of investment, or they can. Right now, it's really the livestock industry that, you know, you might think of having to transform a whole barn when they want to make a major change. But crop farmers may be looking at more of those requirements, too, to think much bigger in terms of their innovations.
Scott, how do you see that?
Yeah, in terms of machinery innovations now, you know, we've never had such a wide choice of what's available. You know, literally, farmers now can choose to work with anything from a horse to almost a robot. And so really, it's going to be a decision-making process for farmers that's really going to have to take into account their specific situation to know what technology is right for them and what machinery choices are right for them. You know, and a lot of times what I've seen personally is a lot of, you know, maybe family or medium-sized farmers have tried to sort of emulate, you know, the large-scale farmers with their process of growing crops. And the machinery that entails, and I think really to fine tune everyone's operation, they're going to have to look at the agronomic advantages they have based on the scale and the type of their operation, rather than just sort of fall into a this is how we do it sort of mode, you know, here on the prairies or in eastern Canada and southern Ontario.
Barb, you're talking to farmers all the time. Do you get the sense from any people that you talk to that they're feeling a bit swamped or overwhelmed by some of the choices that are coming at them?
I guess there's always interest. I wouldn't say that they are feeling swamped or there is some intimidation factor, but in some of the new technologies, but there are always early adopters who are followed by, you know, who sort of make the mistakes, who break the ground, and then others follow along. I guess, yeah, what I hear most often is that they are intrigued, first of all, by some of the innovations that are coming down the pike, and some are eager to try them, and some are quite content to let others break the trail.
What, you know, I'll just throw this out to anyone, but, you know, what makes a farm good at innovation?
Laura, if I can I just come back to the last question just
sure.
for a second, because I, one of the things that we've been seeing, and I think the others have probably been seeing as well, is that there's a real life cycle aspect to this. So farmers maybe mid-career are most likely to be looking at making major changes and adopting new technologies. They've finally got to the point where they've got some equity behind them. They have some security. They have an opportunity risk might be a large word, but they have some opportunity to try some new things and to venture into some new equipment and new other opportunities. Then when they get maybe into their later 50s and into their 60s, they're really facing a difficult choice then about whether they continue to invest in the farm and invest in new technology and new innovations for the farm on the hope that the next generation might be coming along, or whether it's time just to stick with the tried and true and just keep on farming the way they are until it's time to for them to exit, for them to retire and to sell the farm off to someone else.
So
that's one of the areas where we see that is a decision that takes a lot of wrestling on a family's part, and it introduces all sorts of considerations about succession planning and how much to invest in the farm and how to be fair to others in the family who aren't going to farm, et cetera. They're really tough decisions.
So at the very point where they have the financial ability and the security to take some risk, they're at a point in their career that it really doesn't make a lot of sense for them to stick their necks out. So that's really going to depend on whether they have another generation that's coming up through the ranks.
And one of the things that we hear from the younger generation when the younger generation goes back to the farm is that, you know, sometimes mom and dad don't want to give up control over the management decisions that are being made on the farm. And with some of these new technologies, I think just naturally sometimes it's the younger people who are most interested in them, really gung-ho to try new things. Mom and dad have been around for a little longer. They know not everything works out as easily as it looks when you first hear about it. And they're more reluctant to invest, and it's their money after all that's being invested. So this causes some friction sometimes amongst the two generations, although we're talking to a lot more farmers that are finding ways past that with the two generations cooperating on new technology investments and new innovation investments. And when they figure that out, when they learn how to work together, boy, it really seems to draw the whole family together and improve the odds for a successful succession.
I'd have to agree with Tom. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of you know how decisions making goes on these days on the farm, especially with a sort of a baby boomer generation looking to hand over the reins to a millennial group.
Yeah, economics definitely is the deciding factor on how far you want to go with embracing some of the innovations in farming these days.
Well, that certainly leaves us with something to be thinking about as we head into a new year. I know I'm looking forward to seeing how some of these things that are still at the very experimental stage start to play out. But I just wanted to thank you all for joining us this morning. Scott Garvey writes for Grain News, and he's based in Moosomin, Saskatchewan. Barb Glenn is based in Lethbridge, and she writes for the Western Producer. And Tom Button is with the Country Guide, and he's based in Ridgetown, Ontario. Thanks very much. Phil Franz-Workington follows the markets for commodity news services. He's with us now to have a look at what's in store as we head into 2017. Hey, Phil. How's it going today?
Hello. It is going well today.
What are some of the developments on your radar this week?
Well, this week the big developments in the markets, the U.S. markets, and which flows down to the Canadian markets, is the USDA has a big report coming out on Thursday. It's their monthly supply-demand report. It'll give their last final production estimates from last year's crop and adjust their ending stocks forecasts, which will be where most of the attention usually is on the ending stocks. So that.
So indications from the markets or the traders as to what they're expecting that report to have?
They are generally expecting to see some tighter soybean and corn numbers than the last go-around, which would be conceivably supportive for soybean and corn prices, but there's always buy the rumor, sell the fact, or the other way around, and so the markets will probably swing one way or the other, and it's hard to say what the swing will be. But in the lead-up to the report, soybeans are up a bit today, and it's generally thought to be due to that, and canola is not following along for the ride. And
why is that?
Could be a number of reasons, but the main one might be that the U.S. has a lot more fund speculative money at play moving around there, which is making prices move up ahead of the report, while canola is more focused on the fundamental side. And as far as the fundamental side on oilseeds go, while ending stocks, U.S. ending stocks might be down a bit in this USDA report on Thursday, the bigger picture is there's a lot of soybeans around. Canada ended up with a better canola crop than had been thought, and South America is looking at some big crops of their own.
I guess, too, the Canadian dollar has been gaining some ground lately, which is good news for my fresh fruits and veggies at the grocery store, but maybe not such good news for export prices.
That is exactly true. The Canadian dollar has gone up over a penny compared to the U.S. over the last week or two. So the Canadian dollar going up, that cuts directly into the canola price and makes it stronger than the Canadian dollar, the more expensive Canadian products look to international customers. So that is definitely playing a part.
And what about the, it seems that every conversation we have here recently has been about Donald Trump. What's the Trump effect going to be as inauguration goes forward towards the end of this month?
It's a bit of a wild card, would be the best way to put it. In some cases, sort of, there's a lot of protectionist rhetoric that's been coming out, which, doesn't bode well for trade with the U.S., but that same protectionism means if the U.S. is going to be more protectionist in the world stage, hey, that opens up the door for Canada to play a bigger part with other customers, right? So there's that, and then the other thing that would be involved with, as far as the ag sector goes, is there's a fair bit of uncertainty regarding the U.S. renewable fuels policy. They have been a fair bit of subsidy support towards renewable fuels, which helps boost corn and soybeans, and that seems to be indications are that support might not be as strong in the future. So the soybean and corn people are a bit worried about that. And weakness there, of course, spills over to be a weakness for Canadian grains and oilseeds. Yeah.
Could we start to see things be a little bit more volatile going into the next few months?
A little bit more volatile is always the case, yes. So the volatility could definitely be change is inevitable, but what that change will be, I guess, remains to be seen. So on the one hand, yes, there could be some volatility, but on the other, it also, markets might be going into a phase of more of a flat phase. There's not a lot of compelling reasons to go much higher or much lower right now until we get into more of the spring, and we know the weather and those kinds of things. So, you know, the next couple months at least in winter, we're looking at South America and those kind of things, but there's not a lot of real fresh news to move Canadian and U.S. grain markets.
So I guess we're going to be taking a wait-and-see approach to some of this, but I want to thank you, Phil, for joining us today, and we'll catch you next time.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for joining us. We hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Laura Rance.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. If you liked what you heard on today's show, go to membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.